From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the controversial chancellor of New York's public schools, Joseph Fernandez. He supports a multicultural curriculum that one of his school boards refused to follow. Fernandez was a high school dropout and heroin user before he fell in love with math and became an educator. Also today, carrying on the family tradition, we talk with Ben Stiller, son of the comedy team Stiller and Mira. Ben Stiller has his own comedy show on Fox. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new cyberpunk novel, Snow Crash, by Neal Stephenson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton says he's made no final decision on whether to impose a broad-based energy tax. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said yesterday an energy tax is one option the Clinton economic team is considering to help offset the deficit. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bentsen said a tax on all forms of energy, petroleum, natural gas, coal, hydroelectricity, and nuclear power, is one of the many options the new president is considering. He said it's much more likely to be part of Clinton's economic plan than a gas tax, which Clinton opposed during his campaign. A broad-based consumption tax is also more politically feasible. But today, President Clinton refused to be specific. His spokesman, George Stephanopoulos, repeated that no decisions have been made, saying only that whatever program the president does propose will promote investment, growth in jobs, and reduce the deficit. Bentsen's remarks were most likely a trial balloon. A bipartisan group of senators said today on Capitol Hill that they support the concept of a consumption tax, although they ruled out imposition of a national sales tax. Not surprisingly, the oil industry registered its opposition today, suggesting instead that government spending be cut. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
A team of U.S. officials arrived in Haiti today to begin an effort to process the applications of Haitians who want to apply for political asylum. State Department spokesman Joe Snyder said the delegation is part of an effort by the Clinton administration to prevent a new wave of boat people. Snyder said the delegation includes officials from the state and justice departments who'll try to speed up the process of interviewing asylum seekers. President Clinton has officially continued the Bush administration policy of returning boat people to Haiti without reviewing their refugee status. The president has said he wants to discourage refugees from taking to boats and risking their lives on the high seas. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today the Clinton administration can foresee making Germany and Japan permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The five countries with permanent membership on the Security Council now were the leading powers at the end of World War II, when Germany and Japan lay in ruins. Today, Germany and Japan are economic superpowers, wealthier, in fact, than France, Britain, or China, which have permanent council status. Speaking to State Department employees today, Christopher said it's time for some reorganization of the United Nations to bring it into keeping with modern realities, noting that President Clinton has raised the possibility of giving Germany and Japan permanent status on the council. Christopher said, "I suspect we'll see some developments in that direction." But he cautioned this would be a complex process. When you begin to make changes, he said, there are other people who feel they're entitled to a seat at the table. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 35 points. This is NPR. The Supreme Court ruled today that federal judges generally may not intervene long after a trial to prevent the execution of an innocent person if he or she had a fair trial. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In January 1982, Leonel Herrera was convicted of killing a policeman in Texas and sentenced to death. The federal courts upheld the conviction, finding that he had received a fair trial. But 10 years later, Herrera's lawyers came forward with new evidence, which they said proved Herrera was innocent of the crime, and that Herrera's brother, in fact, committed the murder. The evidence consisted of two affidavits, one from the brother's son, who said he had witnessed his father commit the crime, and one from the brother's lawyer, saying that the brother had confessed to the crime. The brother is now dead, but a federal judge delayed Herrera's imminent execution to hold a hearing on the new evidence. Today, the Supreme Court ruled, however, that federal courts do not generally have the power to intervene in such circumstances. Writing for the 6-member court majority, Chief Justice William Rehnquist said that the failsafe in situations like this, said the Chief Justice, is for the governor to grant clemency. In a rare spoken dissent from the bench this morning, Justice Harry Blackmun called the majority's opinion perverse and said fiercely, "The execution of a person who can show that he is actually innocent comes perilously close to simple murder." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Supreme Court officials said today that funeral services for retired Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall will be held on Thursday. Marshall died yesterday of heart failure at the age of 84. Chief Justice William Rehnquist said today that Marshall's influence on civil rights law would have guaranteed him a place in history even if he'd never served on the Supreme Court. Rehnquist called Marshall the most influential civil rights lawyer of the century. President Clinton ordered all flags flown at half-staff at federal facilities until the funeral on Thursday. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Public schools are in trouble in much of America. There's serious trouble in New York, where gangs, drugs, and guns have turned some schools into frightening places to be. My guest, Joseph Fernandez, has been the chancellor of New York City's public schools for the past 3 years. As a teenager growing up in New York City, he belonged to gangs and used drugs. Now he oversees a system with almost 1 million students. He formerly was the superintendent of public schools in Miami. His efforts to make the New York schools responsive to the needs of the time have made him a very controversial figure. He started a condom distribution program in the schools. He got rid of tenure for principals and waged an assault against the bureaucracy. Fernandez is Puerto Rican, and he's led the charge for a multicultural curriculum. The most controversial part of the curriculum relates to promoting respect for gays and lesbians. One school board refused to adopt the curriculum. It's still in the revision stage. I asked Fernandez to describe how it deals with homosexuality.
There's a section called Family Structures, and the idea there was that in this new nuclear age, we have different family structures than the traditional one mother, one father family structure. In fact, many children in our city schools across this country come from a single parent home. Many of them come from surrogate parents. Some of them do come from parents where there are two fathers or two mothers. And the idea was to start young with the children and try to eliminate any biases that the children would have if other children happen to come from these family structures. It was trying to teach tolerance.
So you're not teaching about homosexuality per se. You're just going to have examples there of households in which there are two women instead of a man and a woman as the couple, or two men instead
right.
of a husband and wife.
And in fact, while some people objected to the age appropriateness, we're saying it has to be done somewhere in the elementary grades. It doesn't necessarily have to be done in the first grade, but somewhere in grades 1 through 6.
Do you understand the fears of people who object to the curriculum, fears that children will have questions that they won't understand and that the teachers really won't be in a position to answer for that?
Yeah, but that's why you have extensive teacher training tied into it. But put yourself, take the other point of view. Students are, a common exercise in elementary schools is for students to draw a picture of their family and then show and tell about their family. What happens to that child that comes from a gay family? The burden that they carry with them in terms of intolerance is just insurmountable. It's very, very hard for these kids. We're trying to teach early on through education for students to be tolerant. We're not professing one lifestyle over another.
So I just want to get a sense of what's in the curriculum about single parents or about gay families. Is it just like pictures of different families in a book? Is it stories about different families that the children would read?
And again, a lot is left to the discretion of the teacher after they go through the training. But for example, it's an entire bibliography of over 600 books. Obviously, one of the books that's raised a lot of questions is the one called Heather Has Two Mommies. And it talks about the life of a young girl that's being raised by two lesbian mothers. But it's done in a very delicate way.
Now, multicultural curricula are really among the most controversial issues in the schools now. One of the criticisms is that we're paying too much attention to self-esteem, ethnic self-esteem, racial self-esteem, religious, sexual orientation. And what we're paying so much attention to self-esteem that it's happening at the expense of, you know, basics like math and English.
Well,
I'm wondering, as someone who, like, dropped out of school yourself, when you were young and who kind of knows what it's like to be alienated from school. Do you think that the schools with the multicultural curricula are paying too much attention to self-esteem?
No, look, I think that's part of the problem. We're still trying to operate our schools like we did 20, 25 years ago. When the problems that our students are facing are different. We have to change the institution to meet the needs of the kids that are in our schools today. And it's not being done at the expense of other things. That's a straw dog that the people say you're not concentrating on reading and math and the other necessary academic subjects. Of course we are. But you also, in today's day and age, have to deal with health issues and social issues as well.
Let me move on to the issue of violence, which is such a nightmare in the schools now. And I think one of the more tragic stories I read recently was about the New York principal from Red Hook who had heard one of his students went home in tears, and he tried to find a student in a housing project, and the principal got shot in a drug shootout crossfire.
Yeah, that was Patrick Daly. That's one of many sad stories that are going on in our schools and in our school communities. And it's not just in New York City, but it's all around the country.
Certainly in Philadelphia, where I live, there's been a series of shootings in schools. What do you think should be doing in city schools where violence is a problem? Do you want to see more police in schools, more metal screening so that kids can't come into schools with guns? Is that the approach we should be taking?
Well, I think that's a short-range approach. We're having to do it, obviously, because there's a comfort level that people get from the metal detectors, which is certainly not a perfect science, incidentally. It's not every kid that's detected. It's because you have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 children coming into a high school at one time. You can't possibly use the metal detectors on every one of them. It's not like at the airports. These are handheld detectors. But people do get a comfort level from that, and I understand that, and they do get a comfort level with more security in the schools. But you have to get at the root causes. Many of our children traveling to and from school run into difficulty because neighborhoods are very much unsafe. There's a proliferation of guns out there that we have to somehow politically do something about. And we also, I think, have to get at some of the root causes in terms of teaching our kids how to resolve their conflicts in a more peaceful way. That's why peer mediation and conflict resolution programs are so important.
You've actually increased the budget for metal detectors, haven't you?
Yeah, but again, it's a reaction. We got money from the city. It's a reaction to, obviously, some students being injured and killed. We now have metal detectors in 41 schools, but I have 124 high schools, so we don't have them in every school. And even at that, the metal detectors, as I indicated, it's not a perfect science.
Yeah. Are there city cops in the schools?
In some schools, we have city cops and others. So we have, I have the equivalent of the 7th largest police force in the country in my school's security department. We have over 2,500 school security officers. We have our own school security academy that they go through and train. They're not armed, but they're taught how to, in a preventative mode, how to deal with situations.
What do teachers say to you, teachers who are really afraid?
It's a major problem. Teachers are not only afraid for themselves, but they're afraid for their students. And in fact, just recently in the paper, I don't know if you noticed, the National Education Association made a plea to the new administration in terms of school safety to see if we can work together to come up with some solutions.
What would you like to see? What do you think are possible solutions?
Well, I think politically, guns have to be taken off the streets. Guns can't be made as easily accessible as they currently are. And our mayor, for example, has been screaming trying to get that sort of legislation passed. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that we have to be dealing with our students in terms of these conflict resolution programs.
Let me get to another program that you developed. And this was a condom distribution program, which earned you the nickname of King Condom, which I'm sure you're really thrilled about. Now, what's the status of that program now? Are condoms being distributed in New York's public schools?
They're not distributed. They're made available.
Made available, yeah right.
It's
I know.
It's
the wrong word, isn't it?
Well, that's the word the opponents use. It makes it sound like it's condoms are being given out willy-nilly.
Yeah.
We have an AIDS epidemic that we're facing. Anyone that doesn't recognize that has their heads in the sand. Next year, it's projected there'll be 1 million teenage pregnancies in this country. So our adolescents are, in fact, having sex. Now, our HIV-AIDS instructional program stresses abstinence. It tells students, teenagers, that the only sure way of not getting the virus is by abstinence, the only sure way. However, if you're going to have sex, and knowing full well that the condoms are not infallible, it's a 14 to 17% failure rate, depending on which literature you read, that we felt it was necessary to have condoms made available for those students that, in fact, wanted to use them.
So how does it work? How, if you're a student, how can you get a condom?
Well, first of all, there's six classes involved in HIV/AIDS. There are six required hours of instruction to take place for every high school student in our schools. And then there is a health resource room that is manned by volunteers that have been trained through the Academy of Medicine here in New York City. Each school is a little bit different. Some of them have the resource open every period of the day. Some of it just have it open during lunch period, before school, after school. Some of them are made available through where we have school clinics. But a student would go to one of these resource rooms and request the availability of condom. And with it, he would be given some literature, again, emphasizing abstinence, and again, also talking about the failure rate of condoms. And that would be it.
How are the prices? Are they competitive with the drugstores?
They don't pay for it.
Oh, it's free?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that's the advantage of getting through the school for a student over going to...
Well, not only that, when you talk to students, many of them will not go to a drugstore to get it done. Many of them are embarrassed by that.
Uh-huh.
Many of them can't afford it.
Right. You had a lot of opposition from the church.
Oh, of course, yeah. We recognize that, and opposition from other groups, not just the church, but... It's very similar to, it's deja vu when human growth and development sex education programs were put in the schools in the 60s.
So how did you deal with the opposition? What was your strategy?
Well, we basically had a lot of meetings, information sessions. We sent our people out to parent groups. Incidentally, the United Parents Association, which is the largest parent organization in New York City, supports us on the HIV/AIDS condom availability program. So we did have a lot of support in it, and schools came into the program at different times. But over the last year now, every single school, high school that is, in New York City is in the program.
My guest is Joseph Fernandez, who's the Chancellor of Public Schools in New York, author of a new memoir called Tales Out of School. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Fernandez, Chancellor of New York's Public Schools. You say in your new book that people always want schools to return to what schools were like back when they were young. And when people talk about improving the schools and making them better, what they're really thinking of is making those schools into what schools were like back when they were in school.
Mm-hmm.
Any chance you think we're ever going to return to the old days?
Well, I'm surprised you didn't say the good old days because the good old days weren't always good for some people. The good old days certainly weren't good for young African Americans. They certainly weren't good for Puerto Ricans in New York City. And I doubt very seriously if they were good even for recent other immigrant arrivals. But look, the reality of the matter is that the issues facing children in the cities today is totally different than it was 20 years ago. A large number of our kids come from a single-parent home. We have a lot of dysfunctional families out there. That's not to say that single-parent homes are dysfunctional. I want to be clear about that because... They're very good family structures, too. But my point is that it's not the traditional Ozzie and Nelson, Harriet family, Ozzie and Harriet family out there like we used to have where students came home and somebody was there waiting for them. We have hundreds of thousands of latchkey students. We don't have the after-school programs that we used to have. So there's a lot of things missing in the lives of youngsters that have to go through the streets to get to their schools today, plus all of the other things we've been talking about, the danger and the drugs and the mm-hmm. gangs and all of that violence.
So if we don't look back and try to make the schools into what they once were, then that means we have to look to a future which might be very different from anything we know. When you look ahead, what kind of models do you see in your mind?
Well, we see models like the model we just opened up in the Washington Heights area, which is a very dominant the Dominican Republic area, with the Children's Aid Society, a collaboration where the school is open 7 days a week till 10 o'clock at night, and it's used as a total community resource, including physical and counseling services, including parent training programs, including dental services. We see models where we're creating small high schools, 500 to 700 students, because our very large high schools are very impersonal, and students get lost in the numbers. And we see schools where teachers and students and parents are moving together in a cooperative learning model. We see schools that are ungraded schools in the early grades, and students move at their own rate of accomplishment in terms of understanding the, programs that we're putting in front of them. We see a lot of different things in the future, and a lot of that is happening right now. We see schools that are managed collaboratively by teachers and administrators and parents and community-based organizations. We see schools that are thematic in nature, that are focusing on a particular theme that students have an interest in. Everything we're doing is tied into the research in terms of where at-risk kids and other children will be more successful in the schools.
What did school mean to you when you were young?
Well, it meant different things. And look, I don't want to put the burden of what happened to me totally on the schools, but a lot of it was because there was no connection between my community and the school. There was no connection between me and the school. It was a place I had to go to. One of the sad experiences of my life is that I can only think about three or four teachers that I can remember that obviously made an impression on me. There was just that connection was missing. That's what we're trying to do, is reconnect our parents and our children back with the schools.
Were there people, either your parents or teachers, who tried to convince you to love school and to do your homework and so on?
I was very lucky because I was a good student in terms of the academics always came very easy to me. And so it was that part of it was easy for me. It was the social adjustment that was more difficult for me. More often than not, I was a minority. I was generally not part of the mainstream, if you will. And you had to learn how to survive in that, which is fine. That's part of growing up in the city, and I don't regret that. I'll always be thankful for my, street smarts, if you will, that I learned while I was growing up in the city. But when I needed the connection to be made, it wasn't there. When I started getting involved, unfortunately, with drugs, the connection with school wasn't there of counseling to help me. When I wanted to leave school, there was nobody there except my parents trying to get me to stay. And those are the kind of things that I think we missed the boat on.
So when you were growing up and you really didn't care much about school, you were in a gang, you used drugs, you dropped out of school, you joined the Army, but you ended up kind of coming back to school, falling in love with math and becoming an educator. Where was the turnaround?
I think probably the military for me was the turnaround in terms that it brought some structure, some balance to my life. And incidentally, the military probably wouldn't have been available to me today because I was a high school dropout. The military, as you know now, is much more selective in terms of who they take. And certainly, my understanding, particularly with a volunteer force, which it was then too, they weren't going through the draft at that point, would take high school dropouts and work with them. But even today, that's not available for many of our kids. That's why it's so important that we get to them and reduce the dropout rates and increase the graduation rates.
So how did the military change you?
Well, as I said, I think it brought some structure to me. I realized that there was something beyond 125th Street and Amsterdam Avenue in the world. I got to see people that were older than me and what they did or did not do with their lives. And, I just matured, I think.
And after the military, you decided to go back to school?
Well, I finished my high school in the military. I got the GED diploma. And when I came out, I went to Columbia University and matriculated there on the GI Bill. And I guess that's one of the stories I'm trying to tell with the book, that only in this country, I think, can people redeem themselves again, have second and third chances to really straighten themselves out.
Do you think that it's possible for the schools to really change before society does? As long as there's the kind of poverty and hopelessness and crime and drugs
in the neighborhoods that schools are in, can the schools really protect kids from it?
It's very hard because schools, after all, merely reflect what's going on in society, particularly in the communities that the schools are. But I think we can't help but hope and fight for that. I'm the eternal optimist. I'm very hopeful that with this new administration that we have, that education will become a focus. We know, for example, Head Start programs. We know they work. Everyone knows they work. And yet only 40% of the eligible students are getting access to Head Start. And this administration, for example, has indicated that they're going to fully fund it. That's a very key step. So there's different ways that the federal government can really help to push this agenda along. But we need that same sense of urgency that we had with Desert Storm and that we have with this SNL, issue. That we need the same kind of sense of urgency we had back in Sputnik if we're going to turn our schools around.
After the principal from the Red Hook School was shot and killed, mm-hmm. did you go to any of the schools afterwards and talk directly with students or teachers?
Yeah, in fact, I went to Mr. Daly's school, and we have intervention teams that we send to the schools when something like this happens. These are trained counselors to help students and faculty and parents deal with the grief. It's a very emotional experience that they go through. It's very emotional, very heart-wringing experience that the students, first of all, don't understand why it happens, the teachers, the parents. And I went along with the mayor. We went and we spoke to the parents. We spoke to students in the classes. We visited the classes. We then walked together along with the parents over to the projects, to the spot where he was killed. That's one of the toughest things, I think, for me to deal with when a student or a teacher or another employee get injured like that. It's very hard. There's no training for that.
When you got involved in education, did you ever think you'd be involved with murders and guns and police in the schools?
Not really. You know, and that's another one of the things that I think our colleges are looking at in terms of training our teachers. That's why it's so important to train our teachers in terms of resolving conflicts so they know how to deal with their students in a way that it shows the students that there's other ways of dealing with your problems besides violence. We have to train our teachers in multicultural concepts because more often than not, the training programs don't take that into consideration. So this a whole thing of training and retraining your staff members in terms of preparing them for what's actually in the schools today.
Joseph Fernandez, I want to thank you very much for talking
with
us. Joseph Fernandez is the Chancellor of New York City's public schools and author of the new memoir, Tales Out of School. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Ben Stiller. He's the son of the comedy team Stiller and Mira, and he's gone into the family business. He's starring in his own TV comedy series, which airs Sunday nights on Fox. His sketches have satirized MTV, arrogant rock stars, oversexed commercials, and wheeler-dealer agents. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, author of the cult novel Zodiac the Eco-Thriller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton met today with the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the White House and once again said that he will carry out his pledge to lift a ban on homosexuals in the military. While a spokesman said the military officials objected to the plan, they indicated their respect for his decision-making powers as Commander-in-Chief. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Although Mr. Clinton's promise did not figure prominently in the campaign, he repeated it just days after he was elected, and it has turned into one of the president's most contentious problems. The military leadership is opposed, some bitterly, to lifting the prohibition on homosexuals, and their position has strong support on Capitol Hill. The president's new defense secretary, Les Aspin, has been trying to work out an accommodation with the military. Today, the president stressed again that he is committed to ending the ban, but he's interested in getting the military's input about how to do it. The president has approved a two-step plan devised by Aspin. The first step would direct the military to stop asking about the sexual preference of recruits and stop investigations into suspected homosexual soldiers. Then, after about 6 months of consultation with the Joint Chiefs, an executive order lifting the ban would be issued. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton will take his cabinet to Camp David this weekend, his first weekend away from Washington since being sworn into office last week. Mr. Clinton plans to travel to Camp David Friday, and cabinet members will join him there on Saturday. A White House spokesman said it's a chance for the new Clinton administration to make its plans for the first 100 days in office. In Geneva, Bosnian peace talks continued today despite a Croatian offensive against Serbian insurgents in Croatia. The peace talks came under verbal attack from Bosnia's Muslim president. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports.
Izetbegovic said no progress is being made at the peace conference on finding an end to the 10-month-old conflict. He also denounced the peace plan drafted by international mediators Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen as a de facto division of Bosnia along ethnic lines. But he said the Bosnian Muslims would not abandon the talks, which are also threatened by the Croatian offensive against a Serbian enclave in Croatia, as long as, Izetbegovic said, the conference helps calm down the situation. Asked if he thought international military intervention was now necessary, the Bosnian president could not hide his scorn for the world community. He said military intervention is already half a year late. He said at least 1,000 people are killed daily in Bosnia, adding that if the world community had acted earlier, all those lives could have been saved. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 35 points to close at 3,292.20. on volume of some 288 million shares. Advancing issues led declines. This is NPR News. According to top UN officials in Iraq, Baghdad has turned over a list of what it says includes 90% of foreign suppliers to its nuclear weapons programs. However, both UN and U.S. officials say all of Iraq's nuclear suppliers must be disclosed. Despite a number of statements indicating high tension in the region, there have been no new incidents reported today involving U.S. planes and Iraqi radar. More U.N. inspectors have arrived in Iraq in the wake of a series of U.S.-led air attacks in southern Iraq. How these U.N. inspectors are treated is considered a test of Iraqi compliance with Persian Gulf War ceasefire terms. President Clinton has announced what had been speculated last week, that his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, will head his health care reform team. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more on the story.
Hillary Clinton has her work cut out for her. She'll be in charge of a task force made up of 6 cabinet secretaries as well as assorted advisors. They are supposed to develop a health care plan that will hold down the nation's skyrocketing medical bill, guarantee care for everyone, and pass Congress. Her husband is confident she'll come through.
I think that in the coming months, the American people will learn, as the people of our state did, that we have a First Lady of many talents, but who most of all can bring people together around complex and difficult issues to hammer out consensus and get things done.
And not only will she get things done, the president says, he expects that Mrs. Clinton will have a plan by May 1st. This is Joanne Sulberner in Washington.
Chelsea Clinton slipped quietly into school this morning, avoiding reporters outside the Sidwell Friends School in Washington. 12-year-old Chelsea arrived at the private school for her first day of classes by going in a side door and thus avoiding the main entrance. She was accompanied by her mother. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Comedy was the family business when Ben Stiller was growing up. His parents are the comedy team of Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. Ben Stiller has his own comedy show on Fox, and I spoke to him right before its premiere in September. The show has lampooned MTV, pretentious rock stars, movies, television, commercials, and confessional video journals. In one sketch, Ben Stiller played a Hollywood agent trying to convince his clients, like Roseanne and Tom Arnold and Gary Shandling, to make disease movies.
Let's get serious. Come on, you guys are too good for comedy. I mean, let's do a disease, all right? Tom, you get sick. Rosie, you come and take care of him. Rosie, you get sick. Tom takes care of you. I mean, I don't care. It works both ways. You both get sick, you die, you fall in love, whatever, right? You're the creative ones. You can figure it out.
We're beginning to feel like maybe you're not the right agent for us.
What? This is a bit, right? Doing a thing? I love it. All right, keep going. Come on.
You haven't done crap for us.
All right. Where's the punch? Oh, come on, Rosie. Come on. What do you want? You're number one. Where else can we go?
The show was number one when we hired you.
Whew. This weight loss thing is really playing with your heads, guys. I mean, really, is this the Slim Shake talking? Because if it is, let's go across the street, let's get a cheeseburger, fries, fried chicken, load it up and eat it, because nothing is worth this, all right? Let's face it, the diet is killing your careers. Fat is funny. You go back in time, Greeks, Romans, in the tub, rub-a-dub-lub, 3 men having fun.
Is this based on an agent that you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, he's my my ex-agent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's, yeah. I'm 5 years I had him. And, he wasn't a bad guy. He actually worked really, really hard for me. And this is how I pay him back.
So is this why he's your ex-agent?
Yeah, it is. Gosh, he threatened to sue me. Actually, he made me if I made the name too similar to his. But yeah, you know, all agents have a certain amount of I don't know what it is, like a kind of a bull factor, I guess. They're always kind of blowing smoke at you, and they talk in circles. And this guy kind of just talks around and around. He'll be pitching horrible ideas. You know, you should do a sitcom. You know, you could be doing a thing with Bea Arthur. You know, it's you and her, and she's, you know, she lives next door, and she's gruff, and you're crazy, but you know, you like her, but you don't like her, and then all of a sudden something happens. You teach each other how to love. It's beautiful, you know? And, you know, he just kind of, they always deal in concepts, you know?
Did you ever try to go along with him on one of these ideas and really get your hopes up that you were going to do this sitcom with Bea Arthur and teach each other how to love?
Yeah, for 5 years. I was... He's calling me up with these ideas. And then when I started directing, he would, like, call me up with these just things that he'd never, totally untrue. It would be like, you want to direct Ice Cube's new video? I go, I don't know. You know, I'm like a Jewish kid from New York. You really think he wants me? He goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, well, I'll talk to him about it. You know, the only thing is you got to go to Compton every day, but you could deal with that, right? Meanwhile, he never even talked to him. He'd always be throwing out stuff like that. So you learn to kind of not take it too seriously after a while and just kind of take notes so that you can use it down the line on your own show, hopefully, you know?
You
can do something productive with it.
Is it hard to break up with an agent? Did you feel very guilty about it?
Yeah, it is, actually. It's really hard because you do develop a close relationship because, you know, an agent has your career in his hands and actors are really insecure and you're kind of always, you know, he's your link to the outside world. He's going to be taking all the offers or auditions that you go on. He gets the feedback and he tells you and he has to kind of sift it through to you without, you know, kind of dealing with that fragile ego that actors have. So, he's your link, and if you develop a bond with him in some way, because it's kind of like this codependent relationship that develops, you know, where you really need to you need the approval, and so when it finally comes time to change, it's like breaking up with a girlfriend or something like that, because you know there are always aspects that you really like about the person, but you also know that you have to move on. So it's not easy.
It sounds like there should be special agents whose job it is to represent you when you're breaking up with your own agent. So, because this is the one place where you've got nobody to represent you.
That's what your manager is for.
Oh, I see.
They deal with your agent.
Okay.
They
tell you. My guest is Ben Stiller. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with comedian Ben Stiller. Your parents are Jerry Stiller and Mira.
No, that's not them. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes.
That's another Stiller.
Right.
No, I'm sorry.
So were there lots of showbiz people around the house when you were growing up?
Yeah, there were. It was kind of, it was a crazy, crazy household. It was Rodney Dangerfield would come over for Thanksgiving. Andy Kaufman came over. And have chocolate milk at Passover. Weird things.
When you were growing up, were your parents in the kitchen working out routines?
And yeah, they were in the living room. Actually, they were. They had an office in the living room, and they would close the door, and we would hear them working on their routines. It was. And my dad had this reel-to-reel tape recorder. I used to love gadgets and stuff, and I just thought he had this great reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I was about 7 or 8, and all I could think of was, when my parents die, I'm going to inherit this tape recorder. That was all I thought. That was the coolest thing in the world.
What were you going to do with it?
I was going to make my own tapes and, you know, probably like record soundtracks to movies, you know, because I made Super 8 films. And So they would go in there and they would work on their stuff. And, you know, they'd take us on the road with them when they would go and do Las Vegas or go out to California.
Oh, boy. Share with us a memory of being on the road with your parents when they were doing Las Vegas.
Okay, let's see. Well, there was, we spent a lot of time in motels, and I remember my folks, they worked with people like Lola Falana, and, you know, they were, you know, they had their brushes with like Frank Sinatra and people like that. I never met him, but there was also a lot of time hanging out on sets. Like, my parents took us on the Partridge Family set in California, and,
Now, was that a thrill, or did you think, oh, this is, what an absurd show?
No. I was totally into it, you know? I mean, I thought this is, you know, so cool. Danny Bonaducci was, like, kind of flirting with my sister, which is funny now in retrospect. But, my parents did The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
And I remember Brandon Cruz, who was Eddie on the show, came up to me, and we were about the same age, and I had this candy bar, and he just knocked it out of my hand. Like in this kind of show of his power on the set to kind of just establish who was the boss on the set. And then he walked away from me. I'll never forget that one.
How did you feel?
I felt small. I felt, I was just kind of shocked, I think. You know, I didn't know, you know, who this guy was. But, you know, that was kind of tempered by Bobby Brady waving to me from the stagecoach when they were doing the Grand Canyon episode. You know, so, I mean, and that's real. I mean, that's true. So,
making you feel like you were really somebody.
That's right. It kind of brought me back up again.
So did your friends' parents work in show business too?
I had some friends whose parents were in show business. But, you know, we grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and it was it's not like a typical environment. It's not like suburbia, and it's not middle America at all. And I think, you know, I never really knew what a normal environment was like. I thought when I finally kind of got out of New York a little bit, I was kind of fascinated by the suburbs. I went to do a movie like 5 years ago in Cincinnati, and I just thought it was the most amazing place in the world, because it was like, here are all these like houses that I'd seen in commercials, you know. I met this girl. I started going out with this girl there, and I just was, I think I was more into her family, which, you know, they had a dog, and she had a little brother, and her father was like Mr. All-American. He'd been in the Air Force, and he played football, and they, you know, it just was like, this is, wow, this is America. And I felt like kind of this, like, little spy, and, you know, kind of seeing what the rest of the country lived like. So it was really an interesting experience for me. So, but it kind of wore off after a while.
When there were showbiz people around the house, would you feel comfortable talking with them?
Yeah, it was, I guess so. I mean, I didn't really consider them showbiz people, though. You know, it was more like they were just my parents' friends. You know, uh-huh. Those were the people who they hung out with and who were, and we were around the theater a lot, and we were, you know, that was just kind of our life. So it wasn't like, you know, I remember when my dad did this play Hurly Burly a few years back. I was about, I think, 18, 17 or 18, and that had like this cast, like William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver and Judith Ivey and just like, you know, Ron Silver, Harvey Keitel. It was just this great cast. And I remember hanging out, you know, at that point we were older, but these were like people who were more from like, you know, movie stars from my generation, you know, who my dad was working with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very kind of exciting for my sister and I at that point because we were kind of young. We were just getting into the business and, you know, to be hanging out with William Hurt. I was like, you know, a big Altered States fan. And my dad, like, invited him up to our country house and he went fishing with him. So I'm like, fishing with William Hurt. And he's really, you are unique. And he's telling me that.
He's telling you, you're
unique.
He
was telling me, yeah, he was really intense. He would just get really intense. The fish aren't biting. And he would just get very intense about whatever he talked about. And so I was just freaking out. I was having a great time. You know, this is so cool.
What were your early stabs of becoming a performer?
I always wanted to make films. That's what I always wanted to do since I was like, you know, 11 or 12. And
yeah, you said you had a Super 8. What did you do with that?
Oh, I made all sorts of mainly murder movies.
Uh-huh.
Called, like, they called it Murder, I think was the first one. Murder in the Park. We did Airport 75, I remember, where I turned the foyer into an airplane, and then I took a model of a 747 and stuck some matches in the cockpit and lit them, and then put the airplane up to the window and filmed it. And then I took the same airplane and I had this diorama that I built for my train set with mountains, and I crashed the airplane into the side of the mountain and burned my whole train set. So I do those, make a lot of those films. I always like experimenting with special effects and stuff like that. And then as I got older, I thought, okay, I'm going to be an actor first and then go into filmmaking through that way. For some reason, I guess I just wanted to perform also. So, and I thought I was going to be a serious actor for a long time. Like when I was about 18, I thought, you know, because I grew up with comedy, I was kind of rebelling against the whole thing. And I said, I'm going to be serious, you know. And that, what happened was somehow it came out. The other stuff started to come out. I started to, I got a job doing this play, House of Blue Leaves. And while we were doing that, it was a long run. We ran at Lincoln Center for about a year. And then we moved theaters in the middle, but it was a long run. Everybody got to know each other very well, and I had this home video camera, so I started making little documentaries and behind the scenes shorts about, you know, the cast. And we did this one about John Mahoney, who you said you had on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like we called it Portrait of the Artist as an Old Man. And it was just kind of this seedy look at his backstage life, where he was kind of this alcoholic, womanizing lech. And we did interviews with everybody in the cast, like Danny Aiello and Julie Haggerty and Susie Kurtz, everybody talking about how John was, you know, he's just like the, you know, this horrible guy. And then, I mean, I even got John to lay down in the gutter with a wino bag underneath his poster for saying Tony Award winning House of Blue Leaves. It's the funniest shot. And he was great. And so that to me, and then I showed that at a New Year's Eve party for the whole cast, and everybody laughed. And it was, of course, it was a really friendly, you know, audience, but that kind of made me think, hey, I could do this. This could be really fun. And then from that, I started making some more short films, and I did a takeoff on The Color of Money that was about bowling instead of pool when that movie came out, and I sold that to Saturday Night Live, and that was really encouraging. And then that just kind of started the ball rolling, you know, and I started I just said, okay, I'm going to go for it and, you know, do this type of thing.
So now that you have a TV show, when you watch TV, do you see it differently? You know, because as someone who's watched TV a lot all of his life?
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, what I see is just it's really tough to put out a half hour of comedy that you believe in, you know, you think is really funny every week. You have so much to film in such a short amount of time. You're always working against the clock and budget constraints. So it's not easy. You know what's tough, too, is getting on the air. I don't think people understand how tough it is to actually get to a show that's picked up for a series. Like, you know, we developed this show for a couple of years, and, you know, the networks are just, you know, they make a lot of decisions based on demographics and focus groups and all these, you know, factors. And there are so many pilots that are made. And you know, a lot of them stink. And, you know, but there are a lot of good ones, too, I think, that get made and then don't get picked up. So I feel really lucky that we even got to this point where we're on the air.
Are you a survivor of focus groups?
Oh, I went to the focus group for my own show. It was like this surreal high school nightmare to stand behind a two-way mirror and watch people talk about you for 4 hours and criticize you. And all they do is
ask... And who are they?
Who are they? Yeah, well, who are they? That's, you know what? It was the strangest amalgam of, like, you know who they are? They're people. They go to a mall and they say, do you like Herman's Head? And if they say yes, and they say, do you want $35 and a free sandwich? And then that's the criteria. That's it. And then they come up to the room, and then they judge, you know, and they pass judgment, which the network takes very seriously on what you've been working on, you know, you've been, you know, putting your whole life into it. And then these people come in, and you're in the middle, it's in the middle of, you know, your big piece on the show, and they're, like, going over to try to get another carrot stick, you know. And they think, no, just watch it. And they're all different funny types in there, and just they all claim that they don't know anything about, you know, about show business. So they're all like, well, you know, one guy's a mechanic, but then he's saying, you know, I think the protagonist was rather weak in the first act. And they have all got screenplays, you know, it's because they do it. They did ours outside of Los Angeles, so it was, it was pretty wild to sit through that. After that, I thought I could, you know, I feel like I could deal with anything.
Ben Stiller. His program airs Sunday evenings on Fox, but as of today, it's definitely scheduled only through next week. This is Fresh Air. The fighting in the former Yugoslavia has spread to Croatia. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli brings us up to date on the fighting in Croatia from her perspective in Geneva, where she's covering the UNEC-sponsored peace talks there.
What else do you have?
The Supreme Court has ruled that death row inmates can be executed, even though new evidence comes to light. John McChesney reports on what's ahead for the weapons labs in this country after the Cold War. A farewell to Thomas A. Dorsey, a gospel music legend. He wrote more than 1,000 gospel tunes, including Take My Hand, Precious Lord. And the story of the Baikal teal has been found. The bird's been found in Colorado. It's come all the way from Lake Baikal in Siberia.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Snow Crash is a new futuristic novel by Neal Stephenson set in L.A. and the cyberspace beyond. Stephenson wrote the book between 1988 and 91, a time he says when he listened to a lot of loud, relentless, depressing music. He's a speed metal fan and a computer freak. How did all this manifest itself in his fiction? Book critic John Leonard says, marvelously well, but John was already primed for Snow Crash.
Back in 1988, on vacation in Portugal and Spain, my whole family fell in love with Zodiac, the Echo Thriller, a dazzling and hilarious paperback novel by Neal Stephenson. In Zodiac, Greenpeace terrorists declared war on the military-industrial toxic waste garrison state. So gruesome were its details on the pollution of our harbors that my wife ever since has refused to eat lobster. And I've wondered ever since what became of Neal Stephenson. Till now. Snow Crash seems to have been published secretly sometime last year, without reviews in the mainstream press. It got lumped into the cyberpunk fiction category with William Gibson's Neuromancer. It's blurbed, in fact, as Neuromancer meets Vineland. But besides Thomas Pynchon, Snow Crash will also remind you of Robert Stone and William Burroughs, of Dune, and even Foucault's Pendulum. If you leave now to buy the Bantam paperback, you won't have to listen to another word I say. Otherwise, Hang on to your circuit boards. We are about to surf an electromagnetic wave. In the future, according to Stevenson, there is no law at all, and a nightmare Los Angeles is divided into war zones. There are the privately guarded burb claves, where the solid citizens hide out from a gridlocked, spree-killing, cruise-missile, chaos-theory America. There are franchelates, franchise-organized quasi-national entities, like Uncle Enzo's Mafia, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, and Narco Colombia. There are sacrifice zones, abandoned because their cleanup cost exceeds their total future economic value. And there are shanty towns, full of hardcore third-world unemployables breathing amino acids. The only way out of this Los Angeles is into cyberspace. You goggle yourself elsewhere, into a virtual reality of computer simulations that Stevenson, wonderfully, calls Metaverse. In Metaverse, a hacker's dream world, your phantasmal avatar can play with everybody else's avatars. Alas, someone's messing with this Metaverse. A giant raft has appeared along the California coast, a boat people biomass of tens of thousands of refugees, all of them speaking in tongues. There is also a new drug called Snow Crash, blowing the minds of the Macintosh programming technocratic priesthood. In computer lingo, Snow Crash is a systems virus that explodes the gridwork of your pixels. Here it means that too, plus an attack on the deep neurolinguistic structures of the hacker brain itself. This is a plot I won't explain, except to say that it involves ancient Sumer, the cult prostitutes of Asherah, the Epic of Gilgamesh, Sargon II, Kabbalists, George Steiner, and Noam Chomsky. Our only hope for a binary universe resides in the half-black, half-Korean, samurai mafia, pizza delivery man, and freelance hacker, hero protagonist, and his 15-year-old blonde Lolita-like cohort, a courier between burb claves named YT, with her skateboard and her harpoon. Not only do they board the raft, they also descend into the netherworld of Flatland, which is both the electronic text of Metaverse and the very code of our DNA. There, George Orwell meets Steve Jobs, Aldous Huxley mates with a hypercard, and the prophet Jeremiah is drowned out by Vitaly Chernobyl's heavier-than-metal nuclear fuzz grunge band. Snow Crash will blizzard your pixels.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Rajiv Oblitis and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Robert Friedman about Israel's West Bank and the militant settlement movement there. Friedman is the author of the new book, Zealots for Zion. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.